From WBUR in Boston, it's Weekly Warm-Up, a sampling of the cornucopia of stories and interviews featured on Only a Game, sports public radio style.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Brian Georges was an exceptionally successful high school basketball coach, compiling a record of 451 wins and 44 losses over 19 seasons. Since moving across Poughkeepsie, New York from Our Lady of Lourdes High to Marist College, he's also been a very successful college coach, leading the Marist Red Foxes women's team to a 94-30 record. On Sunday, in Dayton, Ohio, Coach Georges and his Red Foxes will try to take the next step. Marist will meet Tennessee in the NCAA tournament's round of 16. When I spoke to Coach Georges this week, I couldn't resist asking him what he was saying to keep his team from looking past Pat Summitt and Tennessee to a potential matchup with Oklahoma.
Well, one thing we've been very good at is not looking past people. And obviously, if you look past Tennessee, then you might be North Carolina or Duke or UConn, but not Marist.
This week you were quoted in the New York Times as saying that you hadn't figured out how to beat the Volunteers yet, but you were working on it. Have you got a plan?
Well, we've got multiple plans, because that's a team where if plan A doesn't work, and it probably won't, we need a plan B and a plan C to try to beat them.
But you're not going to tell me Marist is just happy to be there.
Not at all. No, as exciting as all of this has been and stuff like that, we're going in there trying to advance to the Elite Eight.
You were a high school basketball coach with a record of 451-44 over 19 seasons and four consecutive state titles, and apparently you're the only high school coach to lead teams in four different sports to the New York State Final Four. This includes a softball state title. Why did Our Lady of Lourdes High School let you go from one side of Poughkeepsie to the other?
Well, the interesting story with that is, in our Catholic high schools, you don't make a lot of money. And when they saw my contract, Sister Lois said, Brian, you've done everything here, and we can't thank you enough, but you need to go try this to see if you can do it, because it's something that I'd always wanted to do. And she said the magic words, and if it doesn't work out, we'll take you back.
So, there's always room for you back at Our Lady of Lourdes.
Yeah.
I love it.
Like I say, they're wonderful people. I mean, you can't believe how great those people are at Lourdes. And I didn't think I could ever find another, colleagues that would be as good as that. But I found the same type of people here.
At Marist, basketball had been floundering for a decade before you arrived 4 years ago. But since a losing first season, the Red Foxes have been 94-30. How do you turn a program around so quickly at a mid-major school?
I think a lot of it really deals with the players and buying into what you do. And I think in this day and age where you have a lot of people with egos, fortunately, we have kids who believe in a team philosophy. I think you need leadership, and we have a great senior point guard, who has just a wonderful refuse-to-lose attitude and has always been a winner. And I was fortunate enough to have a few of my kids from Lourdes who came over here also and, kind of helped with the other kids who may not have been buying into the philosophy first. When the kids started to see that it could be successful, you've got a lot of people on the same page, and that always helps.
Coach, even as we speak, somebody is talking to Pat Summitt about, kids buying into the philosophy and the team ethic and the rest. I wonder, are you acquainted with Coach Summitt?
When you're out on the road recruiting, sometimes you're sitting next to him, and she's always very nice. I met her once in 2001 when my family was on a reunion-type thing down in Dollywood, and I went up, and, she actually came in a couple hours later, and I had an audience, what I call it, because she's kind of like the Pope. But, I had a nice meeting with her, and, I was just in awe. And, she autographed a picture for me, because I'm a huge autograph collector, and her picture has been in my office since the day I took this job.
When your team returned to Poughkeepsie on Wednesday, big reception occurred, and not just a reception from the community of the college. ESPN, the New York Times, offbeat public radio sports programs like ours, all wanting to talk to you. Is it surreal having this much attention paid?
Oh, extremely. I mean, you knew there were a lot of media outlets, but you didn't know they'd all converge at once. And I tease my SID. I said, maybe we should get a deli counter out here and, you know, oh, number 39, you know, number 40. It's just been a whirlwind of stuff. And, you know, like I say, it's been wonderful because, you know, it helped get the Marist name out there and people, you know, hopefully are, you know, getting on, you know, online and checking out our school, you know, not just to play basketball, but to see what a wonderful school it really is.
Brian Georges is the head coach of the Marist Red Foxes. Brian, thank you and good luck tomorrow.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
For 26 years, Keith Glass has represented pro basketball players. His greatest achievement may have been forcing the Houston Rockets to pay reserve center Chuck Nevitt $350,000 for weighing 257 pounds, even though Nevitt was no longer employed by the Rockets. Joining me from the studios of NPR in Washington now to explain how he accomplished that and various other wonders is Keith Glass, the author of Taking Shots, Tall Tales, Bizarre Battles, and The Incredible Truth About the NBA. Mr. Glass, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much, Bill. Thanks for having me on.
Let us jump right to the aforementioned Chuck Nevitt and the weight clause least likely to appear in an NBA contract ever again, shall we?
Yes, I think they've eliminated the loopholes there. Chuck Nevitt and I negotiated a contract with the Houston Rockets, and they didn't want to guarantee him 3 years. They only wanted to guarantee him 2 years. Now, Bill, between me and you, why they guaranteed him 1 year, I have no idea. But once they got to two, I had to try to get him to three. And when I asked them, what's the problem with the third year? They said, Keith, he's so skinny. We're afraid he can't gain weight. He can't sustain it. And he's going to get pushed around. So I said, okay, look, here's what we'll do. If he gains 20 pounds a year, the third year will become guaranteed. And they went along with that. So he had to weigh 255, I think, in order to get a $350,000 third year. Okay, no problem. Three games into the first year, they realized what I had realized all along was that Chuck was not a great player. And they released him. Now, 6 months later, I called them and said, where's the weigh-in? And they go, what weigh-in? I said, Chuck Nevitt's weigh-in. You know, I got a third year coming here. They said, Keith, we don't care what he weighs. We haven't seen him in a half a year. I said, well, I don't care whether you've seen him or not. He's still a human being, and he's gaining weight. In fact, he's eating pasta as we're talking. He made it up to 257. His wife kept feeding him Italian food. And I had to arbitrate, and we won. And people thought that was, you know, that I was, you know, snookering everybody. But I thought it was very clear. We didn't want to be released. We didn't want to be waived. We were ready to play.
We were ready to eat.
We were ready to eat. We were ready to do what they asked us to do.
Well, it's a little ironic that you celebrate your role in the Chuck Nevitt affair, because elsewhere in Taking Shots, you maintain that the NBA is completely out of whack in terms of what players are paid. Aren't you at least partially responsible for the current state of affairs?
I am exactly 4% responsible, because that's what we charge. The public thinks it's 10. I wish it was. My wife wishes it was, but it's not. And absolutely, I'm part of the problem. The only thing that makes it easier for me is to realize that I have been saying the same things that are in this book for 10 or 15 years. I think we have gotten way out of whack. But it's not just agents. It's not just the NBA. It's the media. It's the NCAA. It's AAU coaches. It's sneaker companies. It's interfering parents. It's all the way up and down the line. It's a cesspool that just happened to bubble up to the top, which is the NBA. It's not all the NBA's fault, but it's certainly at their feet now.
Well, let me play devil's advocate for a minute. You say today's NBA players make too much money, which leads them to feel entitled, your word, but one that's been tossed around by lots of folks. But how are those players different from the most successful movie stars, singers, the country's 10,000 most highly compensated business executives, or for that matter, the most successful agents?
I don't think they are. People now are trying to make this, like the problems with the NBA, a race issue. There is a color involved here. It's not black and it's not white and it's green. When you look at the amounts of money in the hands of very, very young people, it is going to only attract problems. And it's not just about NBA basketball players. It's about everybody. You bring up a very good example. What about Britney Spears? You don't think she maybe made too much money too early? I think she did. And I think that the money issue, rather than just a lack of character or it being indigenous to one race or the other, is ridiculous. It's an unnatural infusion of money into the human body.
Well, it sounds like you're saying it's okay for older people to have an ungodly amount of money, but younger people shouldn't.
No, I'm not saying that either. I'm saying that overpaid is overpaid, but certainly younger people are not as mature to handle it. When you're looking at 21-year-olds, you know, what happens in our culture, in our society, whether we like it or not, if you have the money, you do the talking, not the listening. 21-year-olds, 20-year-olds, 23-year-olds, they need to do some listening. And I hope I'm not, you know, dating myself, but, you know, I learned a lot from listening to people. And I had nothing. I was living in a mobile home park. I consider that an advantage now, not a disadvantage. And I think we're disadvantaging, in terms of development, these younger people because they don't listen. They do all the talking.
One of the sadder stories in your book concerns Thomas Hamilton, a 7'4" player whom you represented as he tried out for several teams. Tell us a little bit about Mr. Hamilton.
It is a sad story. What happened with Tommy was he came to me as a 19-year-old. He called me collect on the phone and told me he wanted to leave school. He was at Pittsburgh, which I found interesting because I found out later he wasn't in school. Tommy told me he was 7'4". And he was 370 pounds. And when I checked with sources in Chicago, which is where he was from, they had told me that he was the best prospect, the best big prospect that they had ever seen. That got my interest. I'm an agent, you know, whatever else I'm going to say. That 4% starts dangling in my head, too. I'm human. By the time I flew him out to New Jersey to meet with him, which was only 4 days later, he was 406. When I saw him, he could hardly move, and it was my goal to try to get him back in shape, which we did. I got him with Isaiah Thomas to Toronto. We got him down to 328. He was phenomenal. And Isaiah Thomas, who was the president, allowed him to go back to Chicago to visit. And 3 weeks later, he was 408.
Wow.
And, you know, we got him in a Boston Celtics uniform, the uniform that Larry Bird and Robert Parrish and Bob Cousy wore. We were trying to cram Tommy into that uniform. We could hardly fit him in there. And he had one or two good games, and he just would not socially adjust to anything that they were trying to do in Boston. And make a long story short, he sort of ate himself out of the league, I guess. And I tried to get a hold of him to update my chapter, but I couldn't find him. I heard he's still in the projects where he grew up in Chicago, and that was the end of Tommy.
You mention in the book that in retrospect, you see that Thomas Hamilton may have been manic depressive and that he might have been better off receiving medical treatment rather than trying to catch on with a pro basketball team. Why do you suppose that nobody, including you, saw that this young man was in real trouble at that time?
Well, you know, somebody like me, my interaction with Tommy after the initial trying to get him in shape is by phone. You know, no one spends as much time with any basketball player than his family did when he was growing up, than anybody would, teachers, coaches, that kind of thing. So I think we're all to blame for not treating the problems. You know, we treat symptoms. If a guy is late, well, we get him an alarm clock. But if that lateness is a symptom of a fundamental problem, you know, that I guess that's not our job. in a perfect world, it would be. But, you know, we're in a tough business, Bill. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're trying to make money. They're trying to win games. I'm on a percentage. Let's be honest about it. I'm not Pollyanna.
One of the themes that you return to several times in the book is what you call the sad state of basketball in this country today. To what extent is that assessment based on the performance of the U.S. team at the 2004 Olympic Games?
Not that much of it is an assessment of that. The Olympic Games, to me, were just a horror show and was the culmination of all the things that I'm talking about in the book. The selfishness that I see. See, when I look at the state of basketball, I look at an NBA game, especially a regular season NBA game, and it's just tedious and it's boring because it's selfish. And the reason it's selfish, in my opinion, it always gets back to money. But we've been creating stars. We're not creating basketball players anymore. We're creating stars. And you alluded to it earlier. There really is no difference between Hollywood entertainers and NBA players. Somewhere 10, 12 years ago, the directive came down from the league office, apparently, that we are now entertaining. We're not a sport. We're not here to have kids and young adults play together, learn together, grow together, work together for a common goal, as corny as that sounds. We're here to entertain. And what concerns me is every play in an NBA game is designed to that end. Mm. The players have bought into that. There is nothing that they do that is not geared to entertaining fans. And until we get back and stop accepting that nonsense and get back to it being a sport, we're not going to be able to set the tone as we have before. And more important than that, what are we teaching down below? And that's my major concern. NBA people, I'm not worried about. They're making insane amounts of money. I'm making 4% off of that. We should have our pictures on post office walls, for crying out loud. I'm not worried about us. I'm worried about the message that you send down below.
And the way you put that message in the book, you maintain that the current system evident in pro basketball, quote, can destroy our culture. And I don't just mean in the NBA. Boy, even for an agent, that sounds like quite an overstatement.
Yeah, well, maybe it is, but at least it's got you talking. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Given that the players, the agents, the owners, and, of course, the sneaker companies are making an awful lot of money under the current system, is there any reason to suppose that the NBA ever will change?
No, you're 100% right, and I think that's the biggest problem here. It's almost like, hey, Keith, you're making money. I'm making money. We're all making money. Let's just keep it quiet, and we can keep making money for the next 10, 15 years. I understand that. That's what they told me 10 years ago when I said we were going to kill the goose that laid the golden egg. And I haven't let it go. I've been saying the same things. And like I told you, they laugh at me and, you know, have me go away and, you know, just humor me. But no, I think it's going to be very difficult because it's not just the players who are making money. It's everybody. Anybody associated with sports on a professional level in this country is making so much money that why would they want to change the system? Why would they want to better it if it means making less money?
Keith Glass is the author of Taking Shots, Tall Tales, Bizarre Battles, and the Incredible Truth About the NBA. It's published by HarperCollins. He joined me from the studios of NPR in Washington. Keith, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Joining me now to discuss the week's news is Mr. NASCAR himself, the redoubtable Charles P. Pierce, Esquire. Hi, Charlie.
Right now. Hang on.
It's been a long series of nights with this NCAA tournament.
That's exactly the problem. The best game on Thursday night went until, you know, well past midnight.
The games on Thursday night also saw Kansas and Ohio State just barely survive. What's in store for them as the tournament rolls along?
Well, I think that Ohio State's got to find some way to keep Greg Oden in the game. Single-digit scoring from him is not going to cut it. And Kansas has just got an enormous amount of talent and got hooked up with exactly the wrong team. I mean, we can all, those of us interested in the aesthetics of things, and I don't want to hear about how much we don't like pitchers' duels in baseball, should be just as happy that Southern Illinois is out of the tournament because, boy, are they hopeless to watch.
What about on the women's side, Charlie? Which games will you be watching this weekend?
Well, we got to watch the Marist Lady Red Foxes continue, don't we? I mean, this is a great story of trouble and woe. You've got LSU considering to proceed through the tournament with all the crazy and nasty gymnastiness trailing behind it, and then you've got, you know, you've got a lot of strangers in the brackets on the women's side this year, which is good to see. You've got, you know, you've got Hofstra playing, you've got Bowling Green playing, you've got George Washington, and as we mentioned, Marist. My big problem with the women's tournament has always been that the chalk seemed to hold more obviously than it did on the men. That's not the case this year.
Tubby Smith is no longer Tubby the Wildcat. He's now Tubby the Gopher, headed for Minnesota. You think he'll have success there?
Well, I think he'd be happier there. He's leaving the land of crazy people and going to a place where people are crazy only about ice hockey and high school ice hockey at that. That's a job with some potential. It's a Big Ten school. It's been successful at basketball before. You know, call Kevin McHale if you want further details. And I certainly, Tubby Smith will be more at ease there. Of course, this opens up the festival of cutthroats, brigands, and pirates for the Kentucky job, which will be amusing as we go along.
I'm not entirely familiar with the NBA's arcane regulations, Charlie. Explain to me why Danny Ainge, the Boston Celtics executive director of basketball operations, was fined $30,000 for chatting amiably with the woman in the seat next to him at the Big 12 college basketball tournament.
Because the woman in the seat next to him was the mother of Kevin Durant of the University of Texas, who may well be a Boston Celtic this time next year. These are rules I get the feeling the NBA is making up as they go along. I mean, I know it's part of the coordinated effort between the NBA and NCAA to make one product out of basketball, but this really seems high. I can't fathom the advantage that Danny Ainge would have gained by sitting next to Mother Durant at these games.
Yankees general manager Brian Cashman declared this week that he will not offer a contract extension to Alex Rodriguez, and in a related story, the Sultan of Brunei would like to borrow $20. A contract extension?
Yeah, this is going to be an interesting story as the entire baseball season goes along. The Yankees pretty plainly don't want to keep him in New York. A-Rod pretty plainly doesn't want to wind up, you know, God knows where. He doesn't want to be in New York. The Yankees don't want him to stay there. Unfortunately, he has to stay there. The Yankees have now made it plain they're not going to do anything extra special to get him to stay there. So A-Rod will be his usual cheery presence in the clubhouse for 162 games this year.
In a shocking development,
several WWE
wrestlers have been linked to the ongoing nationwide steroids investigation. The shock, I suppose, is that all the WWE wrestlers haven't been linked to that investigation.
Yeah, we're talking about two or three guys. I don't think our FBI is working anywhere near hard enough.
Last week, we mentioned the most recent ranking of the U.S. men's soccer team, Charlie. I guess it's only fair we should mention that the women's team has also been re-ranked this week. No crooked numbers for them, huh?
They're number one.
Absolutely.
They're number one. They're number one. First time since 2003, and good for them.
Charlie, this week I learned of still another sport besides pro wrestling, skydiving, and ultramarathoning that I would never be tempted to try. Let us talk of last weekend's open water swimming championships in Melbourne, Australia.
Well, I mean, there are problems with any sport. There are hockey players whose career end because of abdominal injuries. They can't skate anymore. I don't have to go into all the things that can go wrong in NASCAR. Open water swimming seems to have a serious problem with, wait for it, jellyfish, which do not get out of the way to celebrate the World Open Water Swimming Champion, and practically everyone competing in the World Open Water Swimming Championship in Melbourne got stung to within an inch of whatever it is you can get stung of.
Boxing promoter Don King was spotted this week walking through St. Peter's Square, waving the flags of Italy and of the Vatican. I didn't know that the Vatican had a flag, but now I do because Don King waved it, and I don't know why, beyond the fact that it was there.
Only in the Vatican! Yes, when you thought that reality couldn't get weirder, he was in the audience for Pope Benedict XVI's general audience. Can I just say there's no truth to the rumor that from now on, whenever the Pope appears on the balcony, someone's going to stand behind him holding up a belt.
Finally, Charlie, the dreams of those hoping to land Manny Ramirez's grill are cooked. Why is that?
Well, because it was a fake auction. There's Manny trying to make a couple of extra farthings on the eBay, as the kids say, and he puts his used grill on there. And things get bid right along, and then some idiot has to bid $100 million. Let's presume this isn't authentic,
okay? Do you suppose it was Alex Rodriguez?
I did like the offer, though, The one offer that was for $5,111.11, which if you move the decimal points around is the $51.11 million that the Sox offered for the rights to negotiate for Daisuke Matsuzaka.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Rumble, young Pope, rumble!
Thanks for listening to Only a Game. Please check your local listings for the NPR station nearest you to carry our show, and please visit our website, onlyagame.org.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with super handling all-wheel drive. More at Acura.com/RDX.